Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show, Science Facts and Fallacies, episode 256. My name is Cameron English, your host as always, joined again by our celebrity guest host, Dr. Kevin Folta, filling in for Liza as she's on our world tour talking about agriculture. Kevin, so good to see you again. How you been?
Celebrity. Like I'm on Dancing with the Stars. I mean, what the hell is it? That's when I know I'm old, is when I watch Dancing with the Stars and I don't know who any of the stars are.
Well, you can't be back a professor forever. You got to do something in your golden years, right?
Well, back in the day when you had, Battle of the Network Celebrities or Battle of the Network Stars, it was like Lee Majors will trapeze over to Cheryl Ladd. You know, we knew who these folks were, you know. But thanks for having me back again. It's really, really nice to be able to think about these things and share some science in this channel. So thank you very much.
Hey, my pleasure. Anytime, open invitation, come on back. And you're right, we've got some important stuff to talk about this week. So let's dive right in so we can spend as much time as possible. So first up, Journal Pediatrics reneges on its commitment to print response to botched article claiming GMOs are harmful to children. Here's what they censored. Next up, Money Grab, how the Environmental Working Group works hand-in-hand with tort lawyers to generate billion-dollar junk suits. And finally, hyper-palatable food, scientist who published the seminal study showing the dangers of ultra-processed food backs away from his theory. Oh boy, that's always interesting when people pull back from their conclusions. All right, Kevin, well, this first story you wrote. So instead of me summarizing it, why don't you give people some background on the AAP situation and then what's going on in this article?
Yeah, I feel a little bit bad going over this again, but in short, the American Academy of Pediatrics is a very respected organization who pediatricians and other physicians turn to for advice, and maybe some parents too. And in December, and then finally in the on print version, they had a clinical report that said, don't give your kids GM crops. Or, let me say that again. They said, don't give your kids, and I'm giving air quotes here for those who aren't watching, GM foods or GMO foods. And so I automatically have a problem with this. You know, what is GMO food? There is no modified ingredients. These ingredients are ingredients that come from genetically engineered crops that frequently have no presence inside the ingredients we use in food. So it goes back to this idea that because we don't like the process, we're going to condemn the product. The problem is that this is written by several physicians, and we've been through the this article, you know, a number of times in different venues, so I won't go into that here. But here's the major problem, is that when I contacted the journal and said, you know, you guys got a lot wrong here. Is there a way we can correct it? The editor-in-chief, Louis First, Dr. First, was very kind and said, yeah, we'll give you some space after the end of the article and you can write your rebuttal. And I wrote a 500-word rebuttal. It was exactly 500 words, and they refused to print it. At the same time, I offered the authors of the report, Time on Talking Biotech, my podcast. I offered the authors of the report time in a webinar, an online webinar with other pediatricians and scientists, and they refused to show up with me, but they are glad to take the time with friendly media sources. So here is where we really see the idea of intent. You refuse to have a scientific dialogue with other scientists, yet you're glad to continue to push your narrative with media that is friendly to your narrative. And that's not how science works. And so here you have, Stephen Abrams, which I'll call out by name, other people who, and of course, Phil Landrigan, who has been anti-genetic engineering forever. These folks wrote this paper in a high visibility, very credible venue of pediatrics, the journal Pediatrics. Yet it was wrong. You know, for instance, they would say, we know the National Academies of Science have said that genetic engineering of crops is safe, but do we really know? I mean, we really haven't tested the BT protein enough. It was a total argument from ignorance. So rather than as science works, where we say, here's what we know, this group of physicians says, well, we really don't know, but we do know. And so this is the problem, is this argument from ignorance. It's a logical fallacy that they use to build fear, uncertainty, and doubt in a good technology. And then they drill into the glyphosate question and say, well, there's residues of glyphosate at parts per billion. And obviously this is a, you know, and we've been through the whole thing. This is a carcinogen or a probable carcinogen. And, you know, the Jiang study says that it's 41% higher likelihood, but they omit the excellent rebuttals to the Jiang paper. So long story short, the problem with the journal at this point is that they promised a rebuttal. They didn't give space for that rebuttal. And I even volunteered. I said, here, put me on your review list and I'll review papers for you. And I gave them my name, and I wasn't just being a, you know, being a jerk saying, you know, your paper sucks. I was saying, how can I help you? And so bottom line is that it looks like 100% agenda. When you print bogus information, you refuse to accept a rebuttal, and the people who were the authors refuse to engage in a scientific conversation outside of their silo. That says, don't trust AAP, don't trust pediatrics.
This is so frustrating, Kevin. As a parent, for one thing, but as an academic like yourself, I'm sure it's even more infuriating because this is your field and you're trying to, like we were talking about last week, you're trying to safeguard the literature and make sure that it communicates accurate information to pediatricians in this case, but consumers, policymakers, that's really, really important. And what's happening here is deceiving a lot of people. And again, it's hard to pick at motives, but when you look at the way that they wrote the article and the sources they cited, it's clear to me, as someone who's been writing about this for a long time, that they knew what they were doing. They knew what to cite. They knew how to avoid the papers that would have, like that Zhang article. That thing has been demolished by really good epidemiologists, and they knew to avoid that. So it's very deceptive. But the point I'm making here is that the AAP for years now, at least 2019, has been scratching its head publicly going, gee whiz, we just can't get parents to take a vaccine, and they just won't listen to what we say about nutrition, and their kids are getting more overweight and sicker, and goodness gracious, what do we do about this? And of course, this is the tree that they keep banging their head on, and that's why they can't see the forest. It's like, look, guys, you are manipulating people. And then it gets out that that's happening, and then they go, well, this is all, never mind the science stuff. I'm just going to get my info from TikTok, you know? So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, it's a real problem.
Oh, it's 100% right. And the thing is for me, it's really personal, because I've paid a price personally and professionally over the years for telling the truth and talking about the evidence. And here's a group or an organization that has a narrative that's steeped in falsehood, that that no matter how much we try to correct it as a scientific community, because it's not just me, it's physicians, it's other scientists, it's other folks trying to fix this, the authors won't even engage. The authors are, no, we're not talking, unless you're a friendly podcast who hates genetic engineering or whatever. You know, I don't know which other ones they've been on. I haven't followed. I know they were on at least one. And so this shows the agenda and it shows the intent. And this is not how science is done. And when you talk about the lack of trust in science and how, and this is why I'm so mad today. I sound kind of mad today. When you talk about the breakdown in trust in science and scientists, it's because folks like Abrams and his authorship team break that trust. They use a marquee journal to spread information that's counter to the scientific consensus that then every single physician and parent who used to be at least leaning back towards evidence says, well, wait a minute, the journal that's from my discipline says, we better put the brakes on a little bit here. Let's pump the brakes because there still are some problems. And I, when I read the paper, I can't see it. And then what's worse is that I write to the journal, dozens of other scientists have written to the journal, And then they double down and they write familiar media for physicians, like newsletters to physicians, other articles online that reiterate the themes of the first article that say, don't feed your kids GE crops because we don't know enough about it. And there's probably glyphosate in there and that's poisoning your kids. And all of these things are absolutely false. And then it reads like a commercial for organic food, which, you know, I love organic growers. I have no problem with that. But I have a problem with when you say this is a solution over conventional agriculture, because there's nothing wrong with conventional agriculture. And it's monitored and it's tested and we know it's fine, yet it's vilified by folks like this. Problem is that the poorest people out there who can't afford to go to Whole Foods and buy a $10 pint of pumpkin bisque, you know, that's GMO-free, organic, gluten-free, now they are the ones who are affected because they're convinced by the Journal Pediatrics and by the American Academy of Pediatrics that they are poisoning their kids if they feed them conventional produce. And yeah, that really, really makes me hot.
Totally outrageous. And the part that irritated me the most, because Kevin wrote a story, I wrote a story, handful of other outlets, I think it was Skeptical Inquirer, one of those wrote a story. So there was a good network of people blasting this. But the conclusion of the AAP article was so infuriating because they spend, you know, 2,000, 3,000 words, whatever it is, just attacking and destroying the credibility of mainstream agricultural science and all of these products. And then they get to the end and they go, well, if you can afford it, I mean, go GMO free and organic. And, you know, if you oversee the cafeteria at a hospital, especially a children's hospital, I mean, maybe go organic if it's in the budget, right? So it's like, this is the kind of stuff that the tobacco industry in the 1950s and 60s loved. This is what they did. And this is like, they would applaud this as beautiful denialism, because you put all of these alternative hypotheses out there into the ecosystem, and then you go, well, I mean, you know, we need more data. It's like, it's the most disingenuous thing. And, you know, you walk into a grocery store and you're not involved in this. You don't understand the issue. And you go, well, I mean, this one's like $1.50 more expensive, but it says non-GMO. And I read that on CBS that, you know, and then there you are, right? Wasted money that people could spend on anything else.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And then that's the sad part of the story. And the fact that they get so much traction from these papers, they get so much attention by the media that the truth doesn't matter anymore. And then this is the part that really makes me angry, is that when you can't count on scientists and physicians to stand by the evidence and talk about consensus, what possibility do we have to do this with politics, with elections? If we can't decide if something is or isn't a carcinogen based upon 10,000 published papers, how can we possibly figure out some of these other important social issues? And it's because of the same two problems, just massive amounts of disinformation and a public that doesn't know what to think. And when you have scientists and physicians who are willing to step out there and blatantly lie to hold up a narrative, this is when we are screwed, because this is who we need to depend on the most to separate the wheat from the chaff. And damn it, we're trying as hard as we can to do it, but in the eyes of many, we're the bad guys. You know, like who are we to say, you know? And that's where I really start to finally, after 20 some years of science communication, start to feel a little bit cynical, because if people on our own team are going to not play by the rules, what chance do we have?
Yep. Yeah. Trust the science. Also, the science is full of lies because of, you know, it's outrageous. But you know, a related issue that we deal with a lot as we talked about last week, is you have activist groups that are also polluting the literature in a very similar fashion, right? They're sort of, they're publishing these garbage studies, and then groups like AAP and other medical and health institutions will cite these junk studies. And that's what's going on in this, this second article here. This is by Hank Campbell, writing at Science 2.0. And he's talking about our good friends at EWG, which we talked about last week. But the situation here is they're just getting more brazen, Kevin, and more shameless. You know, it's like it's outrageous. So basically what they did, they went after a pesticide, and I'll let Kevin explain what it is and what it's used for. But they went after a pesticide in a very low quality journal. I believe it's a predatory journal, if I'm not mistaken. But it's one of these journals where you pay to get in, and then they publish your article. And they said there's reproductive health effects associated with, in air quotes, if you can't see this, everybody, associated with exposure to this pesticide. And we can get into the specifics of the study. It wasn't a very, very good paper by any stretch. Now, the thing here that's really, really outrageous is that within 5 days of this study being published, and Hank points out that two of those days were a weekend, and then the third one was a federal holiday, right? So within two business days, this law firm had their entire case prepared, a class action lawsuit representing people. They're in New York, by the way. So a class action suit prepared to file in California. Yeah. So then they go to court. Now, right, I don't know 100%, but do the math, everybody, right? Less than a week after the study's published, there's a lawsuit filed, right? It takes months to prepare a lawsuit, you know, right? 2 + 2, there we go, right? Looks like a scheme is basically what's going on here. So, and they're suing Quaker Oats, right? So the hilarious idea is this product that millions of people have been eating for breakfast for I don't know how many years now is causing reproductive harm to pregnant women and then later on their children when they're born. It's just, you know, what an absurdity. But here we are, Kevin. So give us your take. I mean, the chemistry here is chloramaquat chloride, excuse me.
Chloramaquat.
Yeah, yeah. What is that? Just explain what that is.
Well, chloramaquat is another herbicide that is present. And it's not, and it wasn't allowed in the U.S. even on grain until very recently. It was used in Europe, and so we could import it, no problem. We could import it. We had a rule about importing it, but we did watch levels. And so these folks are looking at chloramaquat. It's almost like Mad Libs. Remember that thing where you got the book and you filled in, you know, noun and then verb? Yeah. It's almost like you put in agricultural chemical and disease. And that's almost what it's like. This is the same formula for glyphosate and paraquat and all the other things. So what we do know about this, and this is the important part, Quaker Oats, who's their parent company? Pepsi. So this is a company with some deep pockets. And so when you have deep pockets and you use an agricultural chemical in some arm of your business, now you're opening yourself up to class action lawsuits and lots of money for attorneys. And this is, so the attorneys get rich, they're incentivized. And folks like EWG that just want to advocate for their funders who aren't necessarily in favor of normal agriculture, conventional agriculture, they've got their mission too. So both of these places win. So if EWG, and when they do this, they make up their own thresholds. So the thresholds of exposure to things like chloramaquat, very well understood, defined by experimental research, empirical research, defined after experimentation. EWG will say, well, those aren't necessarily where we think they are. We think it's about 1,000 times lower. So EWG makes up their own thresholds, and then they go out and find chemicals that pass those thresholds based upon USDA data. And it's a really lame-o strategy, but it works. And so here's an example where they get a group to publish in, as you mentioned, a low-quality journal. The paper has many, many problems, basing conclusions on very limited studies. Like, hey, we bought a box of Kellogg's cornflakes in Muskegon, Michigan on January 4th, 2014. You know, very, very limited samples. I can't believe that a journal would publish this. Like, they would never publish something of mine based on one sample, especially analytical chemistry. You would need at least triplicates. And so that should raise your cockles here. You should say, well, this is Quaker Oats, Deep Pocket Company, claiming to find levels of something that's almost not there. It's in parts per billion, seconds in 32 years. And EWG says it exceeds their thresholds. And those three things together are really the basis for this whole lawsuit.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the paper really quick. And within 30 seconds, I'm finding things that are just totally unacceptable. So it's a very small study, again, of urine samples, like most of these junk pesticide papers are. But they didn't even know how much of it people were exposed to through food, because how do you know how much of Quaker Oats somebody has consumed over right. the period you're studying, right? So in other words, they had to look at urine samples and then to look at the detection levels of this chemical in Quaker Oats. And then they had to estimate, okay, well, people probably got this much from Quaker Oats. It's like, that's totally nonsensical. There's no way that gives you any reliable information about the exposure in the study, just to name one example. So you said there were others. I mean, what other kind of issues did you see in this paper?
Well, it's mostly just basic issues with sample sizes. And that was the main one, that they were looking at individual samples that were taken from different locations, which is good. But then they're reporting analytical chemistry data based upon these single samples. And you just can't do that. You have to have everything done in multiple. You're looking at things, you're looking at chemistries that are present on the edge of nothing. You know, these are at parts per billion. And so you really do need to have good replication. And it wasn't there in this particular work. If you took three boxes from three different locations, and you know, and then also reported how much variation there was between samples, now maybe you would be able to do some real statistical tests, but it just wasn't there. My stupid cat is getting in the way. Say hi to Nimrod.
Hello, Nimrod. It's a beautiful name.
Yep. Yeah. I told him to get in the other room, and he had to come hang out here. He's.
Oh wow, that's a purr if I ever did hear one.
Yeah, he's pretty cool.
Yeah.
He's Nimrod was the great hunter from the Bible. I think he was the grandson of Noah. And he certainly is a great hunter. He kills squirrels left and right, so we keep him.
There you go.
yeah, but anyway, back to the paper. there's the whole thing basically is another contrived attempt to get a settlement out of Pepsi, who would rather, after watching the Roundup fiasco, say, we'll just pay you guys to make this go away, rather than get dragged through the mud for the next 18 years with juries that can be swayed. Because the problem nowadays is it doesn't matter if there's evidence. It's not about evidence versus evidence or you know, what are the facts. It's not about right and wrong. It's about which attorney can convince a jury of 12 lay people that the person who's claiming to be injured is injured. And that's a very, very easy one for an attorney to accomplish. Mm-hmm. Big bad company, you know, poor injured person. And it's just an uneven argument going in. So we've abandoned the science, we've abandoned data, we've abandoned thinking about these things in critical ways, and we've turned it over to 12 people who are juries of our peers to make decisions about science.
Yeah, so I promise you, the people in San Francisco, not your peers. They're just not. In most cases, and I mean, I don't mean that as an insult to anybody. I just mean that's a very unique group of people. And that's why they stand out among the U.S., right? It's like there's a reason most of those suits are filed in California.
They're in the Ninth Circuit,
right?
Because it's
right. Yeah. If they're in federal court, they're in the Ninth. Or if they're in state court, they're always up and down the West Coast. That's not a coincidence. Just a final thing before we move on. This is a really good tie-in to our third story. But this is from the paper. They write current chloramphenicol concentrations in urine from the study and others suggest that individual sample donors were exposed to the chemical at levels several orders of magnitude below the reference dose published by the USPA, which is the US EPA, which is 0.05 milligrams per kilogram of body weight per day, which is nothing. It's the, you know what I mean? So it's like, even in the paper, they have to say, right, the dose that EPA sets, which is already artificially conservative, it's way below that, you know? So there's no there. This is just stupid. Just totally stupid.
Excellent point.
Yeah. All right, I'll move on. And the tie-in to this final story, I think, is that the rhetoric around ultra-processed food tends to sour the discussion about food production more generally in the United States. And I think this is why this is important. So this is by Nina Christensen, writing for Science Norway. Story is called Hyperpalatable Food. Scientist who published the seminal study showing the dangers of ultra-processed food backs away from his theory. This is about a nutrition researcher named Dr. Kevin Hall, who's done some really interesting work over the years. But he's best known for the study from 2019, where he took a group of 20 people, and for 2 weeks he fed them a diet of totally unprocessed food. And then after 2 weeks, they switched to a completely processed food, or excuse me, a diet completely made of processed food. And they lost 2 pounds the first couple of weeks. Then when they switched to the processed diet, they gained 2 pounds. And so this, for many people, was seen as demonstrable evidence that ultra-processed food is potentially harmful because it's a clinical study and you see a clear indication that even when they consume the same number of calories, the processing seems to have some sort of negative effect. But apparently, Kevin Hall's had somewhat of a change of heart, or he's just backed away from this a little bit. And he gave a conference presentation recently where he said, you know, I'm just not sure about this anymore. And one of the reasons is that we don't know the mechanism by which processing would cause harm. So there's the gut microbiome thing is a favorite one, right? You eat processed food and then it changes the ratio of bacteria in your tummy. And this could be a problem. I forget the other one, that something had to do with it makes you want to eat more. And it's, you know, the foods contain fewer nutrients, you know, so in other words, there's lots of speculation. There's no really conclusive data for any of these. And so as a result of this, Hall has just stepped back and said, you know, maybe it just does come down to calories and the nutrients in the food. And that's what we need to focus on. So he's doing another study, and the design is a little bit different. And I think it's meant to avoid some of the previous concerns, but I think this is interesting. And what stands out to me is that he seems to be doing good science here, Kevin, in that he's looking at his results. He's looking what's been done subsequently, and he goes, you know, maybe I didn't get this 100% correct. And, you know, to his credit, he said so publicly. I think that's awesome. What do you think about this?
Well, his study was done right, and his study was good, and it gave some data, but it was the interpretations that were a little bit askew. And the thing that is important to keep in mind is that in his original paper, which was about ultra-processed foods and in a randomized population, so people didn't know what they're getting or why they were there, they were just offered these foods. When they were offered ultra-processed foods, and I kind of hate that term too, but what they're talking about are things like, you know, cookies and cakes and crackers and all the stuff that's in the center of the grocery store. They were offered these things, and the key word here is the Latin phrase ad libitum, that you could have as much as you want, as long as you want, and that's it. And so if you're offered regular food, like non-processed food, and then you switch to ultra-processed, and all of a sudden these things that are loaded with salt, sugar, and fat come out. Now you tend to eat an extra serving of them, or maybe have a little bit before bed, or maybe have a little bit more because it's delicious. And the problem necessarily isn't ultra processed, it's hyper palatable. And this is where Kevin Hall really starts to go, is that the problem is we can make things that appeal to the brain and to the circuits of the brain that say, this is good, eat more. And we've all been there. You know, I bought a bunch of cookies at Walmart yesterday and they were screaming at me in the backseat. You know, these are foods that, because of our evolution, that the things that we, you know, human beings walked this planet as hunter-gatherers, in most of our time, we were at deficits for things like sugar and salt and fat. So when we found it, we really did a nice job of gorging ourselves on it. And so when that circuit still is in there somewhere, where when we get something sweet, fat, salt, that we tend to enjoy it. And McDonald's knows this. Burger King knows this. All the other places that make the foods in the center of the grocery store, whether it's, you know, Fruity Pebbles or, you know, the crackers that look like fish, cold fish crackers, you know, they all know this. And so it's the hyper palatability that is what's attractive, not necessarily the fact that it's ultra processed alone, right? And he's right. There's no mechanism that says, well, because this thing went through more levels of processing from field to fork, that automatically makes it more likely to be disadvantageous to your health. So,
yeah, really important points there. And thank you for the correction, by the way. They didn't hold the calories consistent. But one of the conclusions was the people in the ultra processed group ate 500 more calories. You know, so, but with that qualification in mind, that makes sense. It's like, eat these foods that are absolutely delicious and that you can eat a lot of without even thinking about it. And then they go, whoa, they gained more weight. It's like, yeah, of course they did, because you let them, right? You know, like my wife brought Girl Scout cookies home because it's Girl Scout cookie time. I mean, I had to put them away because those peanut butter patties are destructive, right? They're so good, you know, right? But in other words, you give people food that tastes good and you go, well, yeah, obviously, thanks for, you know, the no duff aisle, as we used to call it. But there's been some interesting research done. So just a couple of things. There was researchers just recently, they took the NOVA scale, which is what's used to document how much processing a food undergoes. And then they compared the USDA My Plate or whatever it's called. It's not the pyramid anymore, but My Daily Plate. And they just picked foods that are ultra processed. And they said, let's find things that will meet the USDA's requirements for a nutritious diet. And they said, you could eat a diet that's almost 100% ultra processed food. And provided that you limit your calories, you can get everything you need from this stuff. Now, that's not a recommendation that you go eat McDonald's every day. But nevertheless, I think it's an important point, which is that in terms of nutrition, there's nothing wrong with this food. I think hyperpalatability can be a problem in certain circumstances, but I think it's oversold in that, you know, I drive by McDonald's and Burger King every day and I almost never stop, right? And right, it's you're able to exercise some self-control, you know. Heroin is addictive, but most people don't do heroin, right? It's like there's other factors that influence the decisions that you make, and that tends to get glossed over. And there's a lot of interesting literature on this, which we can get into if you want, but that's always glossed over. It always comes back to, you know, these companies are trying to make money by selling you food. It's like, well, yeah, obviously, right? People who sell cars want to make money selling cars, and people that farm want to make money by growing food. It's like, this is not an issue, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I lean on palatability every Saturday morning at the farmer's market. I say, try this tomato. You're going to love it. Try this radish. It's going to be different. And, you know, so introducing people to flavors and aromas is nothing new. It's just these companies have dialed into what are the things that appeal to humans at a very primal level, and encourage them to perhaps partake in levels that ultimately lead to obesity. That tied to our busy schedules, our need for convenience, you know, fast, loose, and, you know, give me something that tastes good so I can get back to work. That's kind of the recipe for disaster here. So being somebody who understands that that this is available, but it's not necessarily the best thing for you to eat, you know, in the no duff aisle, and that, you know, if you're super busy and can't, you know, prepare normal food, you know, find something else as an alternative. Don't always go for the easy one. I think that it's just that we're overburdened, overstressed. We're eating for the wrong reasons and eating the wrong stuff. And hyperpalatability is there for us. And I think that's what's really behind the obesity issue. So I think when all the dust settles, that's what we'll figure out.
Yeah. A couple more quick points. The research that they've done to see if they can control people's interest in hyperpalatable food It's very fascinating. So they will give people the drug that limits the dopamine response that they get from eating sugar or eating Doritos or whatever, right? So the pleasure is decreased and they can say, okay, I'm not going to eat as many Doritos, but people go and eat other foods, right? So they'll go eat rice or they'll go eat like whatever and they don't lose weight. And that's fascinating to me. And what it indicates, and I can relate to this as someone who's, you know, struggled with my weight in the past is, you know, as you just said, people eat for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's stress. Sometimes it's boredom. Sometimes they're pissed off at their boss and, you know, right. You know what I mean? There's all kinds of things.
Yeah. And sometimes there's Girl Scout cookies in the house.
Bro, I'm telling you, man, it's bad news bears. But the point there is, it's like, I recognize that. I looked at those and I was like, I'm going to enjoy these. Right. And then I said, I have to not. None of this, like just two or three, and then no, it just I can't. But that's me. You know, final thing. I want people to do some homework. I want you to go look into the Duke Rice Diet. This was devised by an absolute crazy person named Walter Kempner. He was a researcher at Duke University in the 70s. This guy was bananas. He put morbidly obese people on a diet of 350 grams of rice a day. They could have as much fruit juice. They could not have nuts, dates, avocados, or any dried or canned fruit, but they could have as much white sugar as they wanted. or excuse me, as much as 500 grams daily. Okay. All right. So in other words,
500 grams,
white rice,
so a pound,
white sugar, fruit juice, no fruits or nuts or vegetables. And people lost over 140 pounds on this diet. And he did it multiple times. He published multiple clinical studies in the Archives of Internal Medicine and JAMA as well. Okay. That's insane. Any dietitian worth their salt today would say, you're going to eat how many grams of sugar a day? No, you're not. I'm not going to let you do that. Right. But again, I think this just goes to show nutrition's more complicated than we tend to let on, you know. But anyways, go look into this. It's just really fun reading. And this is what sort of broke me of my fascination with low-carb diets is, you know, because for a while I was like, that's how you lose weight because it's the carbs. And then I look at this and I'm like, well, obviously not, you know. Anyways, crazy stuff. But let's leave it there, Kevin. I feel like we're going to keep talking if I don't shut up. So
I'm good leaving it there.
Yeah. But follow us on X. We're there. It's at Kevin Folta. I'm at Cam J English. Liza is at Dr. Liza MD. She'll be back next week in the chair. Once again, thank you to Kevin for sitting in because he's so helpful. He answers all the questions that I don't know the answers to. Follow Genetic Literacy Project. They're at Genetic Literacy. It's all their content we discuss. They let us say whatever we want, and then they publish this so you guys can consume it. So thank you to them. And with that, we'll see you next time.